Hello and welcome to Cinemakers, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 30, The Nick, season 2 from 2015. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and I've told Mike halfway through the season, I'm not feeling it. I'm not into this show. I think it lost its focus. I think it's too sprawling. And then something happened, and the back half of the season won me back over. I don't know that this is necessarily as good as season 1. But I think by the end where we get to, it gets back to that machine that I think we all loved the first time around.
Yeah, and I think I was telling you that I was sort of feeling the same way until I got to the end and I wanted more. Knowing that the show's not going to come back, I feel like I've got the rug pulled out from under me or something. But I'm a little bummed that Zach won't come back again, that this is the last we're going to see of these characters.
But just really quickly, that was always the plan, though. I don't know if everybody was going to leave, but like I said last time, the plan from Cinemax and Soderbergh and Clive Owen was to do 2 seasons, and then if they renewed it, they were going to do a new director, a new star, everything. So even if the show was still on TV, Thackeray wouldn't be there. This was the end of his story no matter what. Like, this was not a written into the end as like a cliffhanger. This was the end. Even if season 4 was on now or whatever, it would not be the show that we know. It'd still probably be on the hospital. Maybe the new hospital would be built. Maybe it would be Algie's show. Who knows? Clive Owen only signed up for 2 years. He wasn't going to do more than that.
Soderbergh did an interview after the show was canceled and laid out his plan for season 3, and it involved moving the show to 1947 and completely different place. As you said, different director, different star, like a whole different kind of thing, kind of like the way that they're doing Girlfriend Experience, where it shifts so sort of completely, at least at the beginning. In this case, 2 seasons set, and they would just keep doing 2 seasons at a time in sort of different locations. It's kind of a fascinating idea. I had the experience at I guess kind of a different experience of this season than you guys. I felt a little bit like you did at the very, very beginning. I thought, oh, I was all sort of primed to come back. Felt like it didn't quite have its feet under it. But then really soon after that, I was completely plugged into this. I think in retrospect, this is even better than the first season. And I think my feeling at the end was the same thing, Mike, that you described, feeling like so disappointed. Like, I wanted more. I wanted so much more. But also, it was kind of perfect. Like, these 2 seasons together are in my mind kind of a perfect little capsule of television. And I don't know that I would change any of it. And I've got all kinds of reasons for all that going along. But I did want more and simultaneously didn't want there to be any more.
That's interesting that they were going to sort of shift it to be an anthology at this point in season 3 instead of, like, I would have been cool at season 2 even to have just picked up, like, in a completely different hospital or something like that. I don't know. I did just get too attached to these people. Like, now that you say it, though, like, because I had no foreknowledge that, aside from what you said, like, in the last episode, like, it didn't really stick, I guess, that this was only what they signed up for. But now, having heard that again, like, I can totally see it. Like, it does feel conclusive. It does have sort of that exclamation mark at the end. There is sort of a closure to a lot of it. So, I don't know. I just think it would have been a little weird at that point as an anthology. But, you know, I still would have watched it. It's cool. I just really like these characters. And now I really like a lot of these actors that I wasn't familiar with before either. So I look forward to watching them in other stuff now that they've disbanded this.
I kind of like this idea of the 2 seasons. Like, as we're recording this now, which still might be on, although I think it might be toward the end or just have ended, on Starz there's a new TV show called Counterpart, which stars J.K. Simmons, and he actually plays 2 roles. I've seen the first 2 episodes, I think I'm 1 behind, and it's really good. And that was created to be, at least for now, they say, we're going to do 2 seasons. And so I like this idea of, you know, the British TV model of, like, we're going to do 6, we're going to tell a story, we're going to end, and then, you know, if our team has an idea, we'll come back. I like this idea of being like, we're going to give you a little bit more rope than that. You have 20 hours or whatever you need to tell the story. Tell your story.
Right.
And then if you want to keep the world alive, if you want to keep the story alive, if you want to keep the characters alive, we can revisit that at the end of the season 2. But I like this idea. I mean, anthology shows are sort of all the rage on TV right now. I mean, this might have predated True Detective or been around the same time as True Detective, but like American Horror Story was before this. And there's certain seasons where I'd be like, oh, I'd be down for a second year of this. And there's other ones where I'm like, oh, I have no interest in that. Like, I think this works well. I don't know if you have a 3rd season, because I guess Thackeray is probably dead. And that was actually, I don't know if you guys remember, but I accidentally read, while reading up for the last episode, I read that Thackeray dies.
Oh, yeah.
And so the whole season, I was like, how is he going to die? And this is actually, you know, I was just listening to, Tobin, your episode of Real Bad about Swim Fan. At the end, you talk about spoilers.
Right.
And you're talking about how sometimes knowing what happens at the end can make it a better experience. Mm-hmm. And so this whole season, I'm watching, like, how's he going to die? And I think maybe he's going to overdose. And then Abigail dies. I'm like, maybe he's going to kill himself. I did not see coming that he's going to perform surgery on himself and then accidentally nick an artery and bleed out on the table. And so, like, the fact that I knew he died didn't actually make it worse, because I knew there was no more. I knew there was going to be no more with him. I was as surprised as I would have been if I didn't know that at how he died.
Yeah, and a cool thing is that, as with so much of this show, that's based on a real incident, a famous doctor who needed his appendix taken out, which, you know, was not an uncommon surgery at the time, and decided he was going to do it himself for a lot of the same reasons that Thack does this, and died in the theater in front of all the witnesses. And so the more you read about or watch the little behind the scenes of or the commentaries on this show, almost none of the sort of medical stuff in particular, and a lot of the actual incidents of sort of medical adventurism, all of those, or a lot of those, come from real life, including this last one. I had the same kind of thing. I kind of knew, I remembered, I tried to avoid the press about this show when it came out because I knew I wanted to watch it and I just couldn't at the time. But I did hear something about, you know, you catch a headline that would say, you know, shocking ending of End of the Nick and not renew, whatever. So I had a suspicion that he died, and you can kind of tell, like, I feel like he wants to die as the show goes, like, into its last two or three episodes. But I didn't know. I mean, it's, oh my God, to see it actually sort of happen. It was like they went out with a bang, you know?
Yeah, like, all throughout the show, I was really accustomed to the gore and the surgery, and it's really way toned down this season two as well, I feel, in general. When they got to that, like, I just, you know, was watching it in amazement with my mouth, like, wide open. Like, I didn't want to miss a frame of what I was seeing, because, like, I just kind of couldn't really wrap my mind around it, that it was actually happening and he was doing it and this is how it was going to end. Like, I knew this was one of the last scenes in the show. I didn't know that he would go out like this. You know, it's funny, like, you do sort of get, there's a looming dread over the entire season, not just with his character, but with, like, most of the characters. Like, they all end up in pretty dark places. Like, everything is kind of stripped away from everybody this season in a lot of ways. And that whole thing just feels so abrupt, and I loved it. You know, it's like, it's not out of the realm of something that has been building, you know? I mean, it's like his research and his hubris, like, all coming to this crescendo all at once and everything. And it was just amazing. Like, I really felt the impact of that. When Birdie comes in with this shot of adrenaline to bring him back to life, I felt the shot.
What great filmmaking that, as Birdie runs down to get the adrenaline, and it's like, it's all been set up to pay off at this moment, like, for the Pulp Fiction moment, to jab it in his heart and wake him back up. And you could see a million other shows. Like, and this is what's great about Joey's, as you were saying, about the idea of giving two writers and a director, you know, 20 hours to do a show, and knowing they're coming to this point and playing with us, given our expectations about TV shows, that in 9.5 out of 10 TV shows, at the season finale, there's a thing where he might die, and then he gets jabbed with this, you know, with the adrenaline pen, and then we cut to black, and you wait all year waiting to see if he is alive or not, right? And that they're totally going to play with that right up until that moment, and then there's this beautiful cut as he stabs him in the heart with this syringe, and it's all over. And it's just, it's so in line with the show and feels so organic to the show. And as you say, Mike, in sort of retrospect, you can see how it's all been leading to this moment, but it still feels shocking. It felt shocking to me, even though I sort of knew some of it as it was happening. I can't say enough about the way that they complete the arc of the show. I'm amazed.
It would almost be like at the end of The Sopranos, and spoiler for the end of The Sopranos, but I feel like even if you didn't watch, you know how it ends. If, you know, they have the don't stop, leave, and they say don't stop, cut to black, then we come back and we see, like, Meadow and AJ doing stuff, but, like, Tony's nowhere to be seen. Like, it's like this weird sort of button, but, like, it works, I think. We see Algie taking over his talk therapy, and we see Cornelia going, I guess, to Australia, maybe? And, like, we see, like, these sort of finale moments for these guys, and it's just these nice little buttons. I mean, there's no better ending for me than, I don't know the characters' names, but the nun and the ambulance driver getting engaged. Like, I love them.
Yeah, Cleary and Harriet, yeah.
They are so good. You know, at this point in the season where I was sort of, like, not on board until they sort of focus on Thacker, I think the problem I had, we can come back to this, but, like, I think the problem I had was that there wasn't enough focus on Thackeray. Like, he's sort of not the most important character, but I think he grounds the show and, like, things revolve around him. And I don't think there's enough of that in the first half. And I wasn't able to grasp on anything. But what I was getting through when I wasn't really fully on board were Cleary and Harriet and then Nurse Elkins. Her turn as, like, basically female Thackeray is amazing. Like, the three of them this year kept me from I mean, I was always going to watch this. It wasn't like a K-Street situation where I bailed after an episode. Like, I was always going to get through this, but, like, even when I wasn't fully on board, I was into their stories. Like, I don't care about Cornelia investigating bodies coming in through Ellis Island and stuff. Like, I never connected with that. But, like, these characters I was into. And even when the show wasn't what I wanted, it was cool to see, you know, Harriet trying to get through her ordeals, or Nurse Elkins, you know, Lucy Elkins, I don't know, becoming a sociopath? Like, I don't know what she's doing, but it's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue is they try not just to do too much in general, but too much with Thackeray. Like, he has, like, three or four things going on in his life this season. Like, he's going to find the cause of and then cure addiction, right? Like, he's going to get back with Abby. He's going to divide Siamese twins. Like, he's just got so much on his plate. I wish that was cut down to maybe one less, even though it does show him trying to overreach his bounds a lot. And then on the other hand, I feel like the surrounding characters, supporting players, may not get enough time with their stuff because we're also following each of them on their own path. Like, I feel like Lucy is underserved. I really wanted more with her and her father. I mean, for what we get, I really like that stuff. I feel like we get too much Barrow and his money troubles and all that kind of stuff. Like, God. I really get the point with that.
Oh, Toby, you love him?
I love that. I love what they've done with him in this season.
Oh.
I don't hate it. I hate Everett because he becomes a Nazi and, like, that stuff just, like, bored me ultimately when he just ends up committing his wife again and getting together with her sister who looks exactly like her, who might be her twin.
I kind of like that, and I think we're jumping all over the place, but going to Barrow for a second, because I want to hear what Tobin's...
Yeah, my defense of this, yeah.
I think he's a great character, but I hate him. Like, I hate every time he's on screen. I don't want to see him... Like, every decision he can make, he makes the wrong one, and yet he gets away with it all. I mean, in the end, I guess his wife sort of has the comeuppance.
And he'll have plague, right? I think he has plague.
He has cancer.
Oh, it's cancer. From the x-rays? Okay, that's what it was. Okay.
He has too many x-rays, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are melanomas on his hands, yeah.
But, like, he gets into the club, you know, he gets this girl. And I also thought, like, the entire season, I thought his girl, who's the former whore, you know, Ping's whore, I thought she was up to something. And then by the end, I was like, oh, no, she's just a bad actress.
No, like, I thought she is up to something. Is she? Oh, totally. She got him to sign over the apartment. All the money's going to go from the bank account.
Power of attorney.
She's got power of attorney. He is fucked, man. Like, she...
So I guess I must have missed one scene because I was like, I wasn't sure. And I missed that. And I was like, oh, because the whole time she set up to be this manipulative. Why don't we get a nicer apartment?
Oh,
why
yeah.
don't we do this? And so I'm glad that I missed that.
Let me make a defense of Barrow. I think that one of the things this show does so audaciously and smartly is it allows its characters to change. And maybe that's because it gets to be two seasons and then be done, and, like, they know that. So within that, they allow these characters to actually move, to actually evolve, and to be sort of become different people. There's something about Barrow who, in the previous season and in the beginning of this season, whenever he was, like, commanding people around, it always felt to me like he was kind of playing at it. Like, there was just a little hesitation. Like, I'm not quite sure. I don't quite have the authority, but I'm going to act like it. And by mid-season of this season, as we realize what he's doing to sort of finagle the money away from the building of the Nick and all that, there comes a moment where he is fully in command of his sort of, I am now a big shot, even though he's not fully and he's going to get knocked back a couple more times. But I love that they were able to let him be that. He didn't always have to sort of be sniveling. And I think we need to see his evolution to getting there. I also think that what he demonstrates too is the idea that has sort of permeated the time and also since then that, like, you can be a self-made person in America. And I think he gives the lie to that because look at all the things he has to do to climb the social ladder. Like, he has literally destroyed his life. This high wire act he's doing cannot last, let alone the fact he's riddled with cancer from all these x-rays. And that is a thing that, getting back to Soderbergh's interest in sort of critiques of capitalism, I think this fits beautifully into that. And I do see what you mean. I know, and I'm probably just too much in the tank for this show. I was ready to go wherever it wanted to take me. I never felt like, oh, I wish I wasn't with these people. And I think if you do feel that, there is a lot of him in this, and I think it can feel like the same beat over and over again. But to my mind, I always felt like, okay, is he going to stay ahead of the ball in this moment, or is he going to fall behind it? Because I never knew which way it was going to go with him. And I loved how he emerged in this season, like, from the cocoon. Like, when he goes to his wife, she thinks he's bought this new apartment for her, and he's like, well, it's not for you. I've got this other woman. I'm leaving you. I've rented you an apartment. You have to be out of this house in, like, 3 days, and fuck you. And like, she storms out. Like, the fact that he's not going to dance around it, like he's going to come out and say that. I don't know. I felt like I really liked seeing his character evolve.
I hated watching him, but that hate in watching him led to the satisfaction of his downfall. And I also liked that between the vacuum cleaner guy calling and accidentally letting his wife know, he's like, "Ooh, I hope I didn't ruin the surprise," or when she goes to the bank and the bank teller accidentally letting her to the wrong box. Like, it's these people that he has no control over. He has this grand plan. Like, he's like, "I'm going to, you know, leave my wife. I'm going to get this beautiful young whore. We're going to go to this apartment. You know, this is going to be my life. I'm going to be in the Vanderbilt Club." And he does that, but every step along the way, everything he doesn't have control over keeps biting him in the ass, and he's able to sort of overcome some of it, and then it reaches a point where, like, he's got no allies anymore. Everybody's basically against him, whether he knows it or not, and it's satisfying to see his downfall. I just hated seeing his ascension, whether or not thinking there was going to be a downfall. I just hated seeing him get better because...
Because you didn't think he deserved it?
I just hated him.
He's one of the main villains of the entire show, I feel. And, like, I have a show filled with a lot of despicable people, but you look at how Cleary turns around, you know? Like, originally, I feel like in season one, he was sort of marked to be a villain. But Barrow is, like, the kind of guy you're supposed to hate. Like, I love to hate this guy. Like, I'm not saying I don't like his stuff. I just feel like it's a little unbalanced this season. But when he's around, yeah, like, it's really interesting to see how weaselly he is. And it's almost like he's one of those guys where it's like, if you just visualize it and believe it, then it'll kind of be actualized. So, like, he just believes his own bullshit that he is a powerful guy. He throws his weight around, and this season people are like believing him. He's like somehow getting respect because he's in charge of building the hospital, and his wife is throwing this huge gala right before he ditches her. Even when he shows up with his whore wife, people are like, "Oh, okay, whatever." They don't even care about that, you know? And like, he still gets into the club and everything. I found it to be fun and interesting to see the villain climb the chain and then ultimately all for naught. I almost got like an air of like Dangerous Liaisons, where it's like, we're having all this fun, but the revolution's right around the corner. It's mm-hmm. like, well, he's having all this fun, but like, not only is he going to die, but like in a few years, the stock market's going to crash. So all these rich people are going to be jumping out of windows and stuff too. Like, the party doesn't last forever.
I think what's interesting, most interesting about him as a villain, is that he never, ever really goes up against Thackeray. Like, he's sort of villainous to the world, but to our quote unquote hero or our anti-hero or whatever, he never really opposes Thackeray, at least this season. And like at the end, when, you know, the hospital's falling apart, when he's like, there's talk about they might not even do it or whatever, and he goes to Thackeray, he's like, "But you have the whole reputation." Thackeray's basically like, "Yeah, I don't care, like, whatever." And like, he tries to like become his villain, or sort of like introduce this like struggle or battle between the two of them, and Thackeray's like, "Yeah, I don't care, like, that's fine, like, whatever, like, I'm about to die. I don't know I'm about to die, but I'm about to die." And it's interesting that like the big bad of the show really doesn't at all interact or oppose our anti-hero at all.
I cannot more strongly disagree with the characterization of Barrow as the villain of the show.
Barrow, to me, he looks like a stereotypical villain just by his physical appearance, and I don't get any remorse from this guy, you know, and that is a major part of why I think that he is one of the villains.
Before Tobin does his defense, like, I agree with you, Mike. Like, I don't know if villain is the right word, but he's the guy we're rooting against. I mean, I guess Zinberg is kind of annoying and, like, doesn't treat Birdie well, but, like, Birdie kind of deserves it. Like, but there's nobody else really that is, like, evil, I don't think, in this world. And so, like,
everyone's, all the men surrounding Cornelia.
Well, yes, but also, I don't care about that story, so maybe that's why I'm not thinking about them.
Like, her husband's father, her own husband, who you never can quite get a read on, her brother, who by the end of the show you realize is the, I think, the ultimate villain of the show. And then to call Barrow less of a villain than Cleary, I think misunderstands the show.
I didn't say he's more or less or any of that. I just said he's one of. I just saw him to be a stereotypical villainous type. I singled him out mostly based just on his looks, I guess, because he has that look to him. For me, I just found that he didn't have the charisma that the other people did, that, well, they're doing bad, I can kind of forgive them eventually. But for him, he just didn't have that. He didn't have enough charisma for me to like him.
Oh, I heard big bad. I completely disagree. I think that he is, I don't even see him as particularly villainous. I see him as a man who is has learned how the system works, and now, goddammit, is going to make the system work for him. I don't begrudge him virtually anything he does in this season. I think that he is, to do so, I think, misunderstands the whole system that he's a part of outside of the medical stuff on this show. And the idea that, you know, as you say, Gallinger becomes a Nazi, like he sterilizes, you know, boys. You have Cleary, who we find out at the end of the show was the one who turned Harriet in and got her arrested. Like, it's all his fault because he wanted her not to be a nun so he could marry her. Like, that's insidious. And I like to believe that he turned a corner and that this is the real him that's like been trying to make it up to her all this time. But like, this show is full of what I love about this show is that almost everybody on the show, maybe even everybody on the show, you get to see them be really good and really bad. And I think that's a thing you don't see enough of in TV. And if you see them, I think any one of them as too black or white, it doesn't comport with my reading of the show. I both wanted Barrow to succeed and to get shot down. Like, in the moment as he's like up against the detective, I'm like, yeah, don't let this detective get you down. And then like the next scene would be him and his wife and be like, yeah, you show him, like, soak him for all he's worth. Maybe I was just more invested in him and in these scenes than you guys were, but I feel like he is someone I was really rooting for to somehow find a way through and find a way maybe back to himself, like all these characters. And I don't know that anyone does like find their way to sort of true peace, except maybe Harriet and maybe Cornelia and maybe Algernon. And beyond that, I don't know.
I'm definitely not rooting for Barrow whatsoever. I'm rooting for him to come to his senses and get back with his family and try and make that work.
That's not fair to him or his wife. Like, they should not be together. That's a relationship that should, you know, he should not leave it like this. And he should not like be cruel to her. And the scene where she tries to like put on some lingerie and seduce him is so painful. Like, it hurts for me that what she's like, the humiliation she's going through in that moment. But these are two people who were bound together, as so many of the people on the show are, by social convention, by this is what we're supposed to do, not because it's what they actually wanted. And I feel the chains on him that he's breaking through. I empathize with him. I don't want to be his friend. I don't want to be in the room with him, but I do empathize with him. But maybe I'm a monster.
No, I don't think you're a monster, but I mean, I also feel like the show is presenting him as a villainous person, even if he isn't playing one. That is the way that is just perceived through society. The things he is doing, generally, he's not following the rules, you know? And I guess that's okay. That makes him sort of like more of like an anti-hero. He's clawing his way up through society any way that he can and everything. But again, he is choosing to want to be part of that particular lifestyle, yeah, too. So there's a consequence to that. He becomes a horrible fucking person to get what he wants.
Just last thing, I think that he is playing by the rules. It's just not the rules that he saw when he started his job. It's the rules that he's come to see underneath. It's the rules that the Showalters and the Robertsons play at. It's the rules of paying off the wharf guys to let the sick people
through.
Well,
yeah, he's not following the law.
Right.
He doesn't follow. That's
but following
I mean.
The law doesn't get you anywhere in this society. That's what this is all. Like, the whole show is built around a guy, not Barrow, but Thackeray, who his whole thing is breaking like the quote unquote rules. Like, this show's all about how the only way forward is to break the rules. And it's just that the rules he chooses to break, Barrow, and the way he chooses to break them, and Thack too for that matter, it gets them killed. Like, it's going to kill them. And I don't know, I think that's a kind of, you know, that's a fascinating thing.
Can we talk about one woman who maybe doesn't break the rules, but I think if this show went on a couple more years, she might be like president? Like, I want to talk about Elkins, because Lucy is the best, because I feel like she is sort of breaking similar rules, kind of, in a way. Like, she's doing things you're not supposed to do, you know, she's kind of whoring herself out, and she like that scene where her dad is dying and she confesses to him about like how she put her foot in Ping's mouth and he paid her $100 and she did it more than once. I'm like, this is this weird empowerment that's like kind of amazing. And I don't know, you know, now that we have The Contenders, the wonderful show The Contenders on this network, and now that I have Island's voice in the back of my head whenever I'm talking about women in movies, I'm like, I'm not sure if I'm talking about this right or not. But I feel like in this world dominated by men, yeah, she's kind of giving up her body and everything, but like at the same time, she's owning it, and she's doing exactly what she wants. She's able to pay for that dress with her own money, and she's on this rocket ship from being like this nurse to being ostensibly, like, if she keeps this up, like, one of the most powerful people in New York. Like, she is killing it in like the weirdest of ways.
Yeah, she does feel like the future of. There's a sense in her last scene as Cornelia's almost been killed by her brother and is walking down the stairs, and she passes Nurse Elkins, Lucy, on the stairs going up to be with her brother. Like, these two duplicitous people, Cornelia's brother and Lucy, are the future. Like, she has found a way in the exact same way as Barrow and Thackeray and these people who are sort of like fighting against whatever the rules are. Algy's the same way. Like, his rules have more to do with race, right? They're fighting against these social constraints around them towards some kind of future. And she finds, I don't know that she is ultimately going to be any better off than Thack or Barrow is. Probably. I get the sense she can kind of handle herself in a different way, but I don't know. Who knows what happens, you know, 10 years into that relationship. But it is cool to see her sort of waffle a little bit at the beginning of the season and then decide, no, you know what? Fuck Birdie. Fuck all this other stuff. I'm going to become this other version of a person and to sort of actualize herself. That was cool to see.
Because I feel like in a lot of ways it kind of mirrors what Cornelia's doing, except Cornelia's doing it for good,
mm-hmm.
and Lucy's doing it for self-improvement. And that, I think, one of the most devastating lines, I think, of the whole show, or maybe anything we've covered here, is when she lays out her brother's plan to her brother verbatim, and she's like, aren't you going to say something? He says, shame you aren't a man.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'd be running this town. And like, he's basically saying, you know, you're right. You're absolutely right. But nobody cares because you're a woman. Like, they're both on this journey to self-improvement and like trying to do right by themselves. While Lucy is like, I'm going to live a good life. I'm going to be in the coolest dresses. I'm going to go to all the cool parties. I'm going to make my man go get me drinks. Like, I am in charge of this. And then Cornelia's like, I'm going to try to do right by the world. And what does that do? But it gets her run out of town. It's these two very strong women doing their thing. Mm-hmm. One who sort of does things the wrong way, kind of, arguably, or at least by society standards, is exactly where she wants to be. And the other one who does things the right way has to reinvent herself completely. And it's maybe a happy ending, but it's also really sad.
It's sort of the instance of, I guess, Tobin sort of brought up where, you know, if you try and do things the right way and follow the law, like, it's not going to get you anywhere.
Right.
And we see that with Cornelia. And then when you see Lucy, it's like, well, she's going to do everything the society or law says she shouldn't be doing, and she's going to do it. And she, you know, she gets away with it because there's really, you know, she can. She realizes there's no danger
right,
in
right,
it.
Right.
Like, she is just doing what is natural, basically. And so once she sort of embraces that, it empowers her, and she definitely is, like, in charge of her own destiny. And poor Cornelia is just sort of gaslit, like, to a degree, right? Like, she's just kept in the dark about so much. Like, she has her brother turns her against her father. I feel like if there was just one less thing for her to deal with, she would have figured it out. But there was just, she had to go to San Francisco, and she has, like, the lecherous stepfather going on, and, like, her husband is no prize either. And so, like, she's even got more to handle than Lucy does. And Lucy's got all this time to sort of plot and plan her rise through society too. But there's definitely a very interesting contrast going on through this entire season.
What's cool is that they both start the show in very different places. Like, it feels to us like Lucy's very naive and Cornelia's not. Like, she's very of the world, like in the beginning of season one. And then by the end of the show, Lucy has become so much less naive than Cornelia. And all this conversation is getting me thinking about the ways in which part of the show is asking its characters to figure out what rules they're going to follow. And as you say, the ones who are following the stated social rules, the law and morality as it's sort of preached in the church, the people who are following the rules that way just get completely screwed. There was a neat thing in the, I don't know if you guys watched the sort of talkbacks after the episodes, but there's one after the finale, after the show's finale, the actress who plays Cornelia, Juliet Rylance, she talked about how in her mind, at the time, the reason that she... In her mind, the reason she was going to Australia is because at the time, that's the only place where women could become doctors. And that in her mind, where her character ends up is she goes to Australia and becomes a doctor. Now, I don't know, obviously, if that's true or not. It's what I like to imagine, the idea that she's going to find a place where the rules, where the public rules allow her to do the kind of thing she wants to do. Because the public rules here do not do it. Like, because she's a woman at this time, at this status, with this background, she does not have the tools that Lucy does. And she's not going to be able to, well, I suppose she could get them, but she's the sort of person who I don't know that she could. And so she's got to find a place where the rules allow her to sort of fulfill herself. And I just hope she does.
That's interesting. That's almost like a reverse Algy situation where he had to, you know, he couldn't really study in America to be a doctor. And then when he came here, he's all the persecution and everything that he's been. And he's someone we haven't really talked about at all. But I mean, maybe the shocker of the season is when there's a knock at the door and his wife shows up. I mean, what? We talked last season about how Soderbergh didn't really pull a lot of those sort of like shocker endings, you know, and kind of saved them from when they counted. And I feel like he did the same thing this season too. I don't feel like there were a lot of those sort of like getcha endings, but this is one of them, and it really worked, I felt. And episode 4 was one of my favorite episodes, which is where they sort of go up to Harlem, and it's sort of shot like that part in the Limey where there's the same conversation shot two different ways and cut together, and all that was just really interesting.
I didn't love episode 4.
Really?
That was the one where the subway explosion, right? Wonderful surprises?
No, that's the one where, like, the guy's mustache catches on fire in the operation and he dies. Like, that one doctor, Thackeray's doing, like, addiction study.
That's not 4.
Yeah. She shows up at the end of episode 3, and then episode 4, they kind of go out and they go to Harlem, and Thackeray is hanging out with Abby, who he's with for most of the season. Bertie learns how to be with a woman intimately that episode, finds out that his mother has cancer, or at least has, like, the mass or the tumor.
Oh, no, you're right, because it says this terrible doctor getting burnt alive as he's flirting with a new nurse. Yes, that was episode 4. I didn't like that one because it felt like, that doctor was terrible. I hate it. I guess he was he supposed to be like a buffoon, I guess, right?
Yeah. He's the old school. Like, he's the doctors of the time. The doctors who all trained before Thack. That's what they're going for there. Yeah.
Because it felt to me like that whole episode, or a lot of that episode, was about, like, hey, doctors and nurses are going to pair off. And, like, we see that throughout the season. They keep hiring cuter nurses. And what I liked about this episode is that Emily Kinney from The Walking Dead, Beth from The Walking Dead, shows up as a nurse, and she's in a couple episodes, and I love her. And I was like, cool to see her. She's the one who does that striptease, the striptease in the video. She's got such a small role. The only moment that I remember, aside from the striptease, is that, like, they're like, we need a video camera. And she's like, I think I know a guy who has a video camera. I don't know why I would know that, but I liked seeing her. I didn't love the rest of that episode. There was something else I just saw in my notes that I wanted to say that it was sort of unrelated. Now, this is what I wanted to talk about. It was unrelated entirely to what we were talking about. But I like that John Hodgman came back, that John Hodgman also kind of got his comeuppance. But in that same world, I don't know if either of you caught him. I don't know if either of you know who he is or recognize him. The dentist, I guess, or the tooth salesman, or whatever role he's playing in the first episode, is Todd Barry, who's a comedian, and he's great. And so he was the guy who they were trying to find teeth to put in Everett's wife, who John Hodgman pulled all of her teeth out. That Todd Barry's out. He had hair and a mustache, like, he doesn't normally have those, but, like, it was very clearly him. And I was like, oh, tapping back into that comedian well. So I like that.
We need to sing Algy's Andre Holland's praises a little bit here. Where are his awards? Like, he is consistently, even if there are moments with other characters where I'm a little less engaged, although I'm not to the degree I think you guys were, but every time he's on screen, he has me hooked. I'm sort of entranced by him. And I love what they do with him in the way that in this show, you know, his wife will show up and what would in other series be this ongoing arc, this battle of will they, won't they, like, there's a little bit of that at the beginning, and then it's like, just, this is life. Like, we got to get on with it. Like, you know, like, we've cut ahead in time a little bit, and, like, they're living together, they're husband and wife. And I thought it was really cool. There's a scene, the first scene where she's having dinner with is Cornelia's family, right? And she is from England, and she presses them on why Algy's parents aren't sitting there with them, like, for this celebratory dinner, why they're serving them. And she makes the room very uncomfortable. And I felt uncomfortable in that moment because I've spent this whole show being aligned with Cornelia and with Algy, and, like, they're all uncomfortable. And then I realized that, whoa, she is speaking real truth here. Like, the show has made me accustomed to the way things operate, right? Like, the show over, you know, 14 episodes has brought me to a place where I kind of accept that this is the role that everybody has. And then she comes in and, like, pokes at that, and I go, oh, don't do that, don't do that. And then I realize that, no, that's right. She's right. She's totally right. Even though she is obnoxious, right? Like, she's speaking the truth in that moment, and a truth that I had sort of unknowingly, if you'd ask me consciously, is this right? The parents aren't there. I would say, no, of course that's wrong. That's terrible. But in the moment, as she's, I don't know, it implicated me in their racism. And I thought that was a really smart thing for the show to do.
Well, I think what's really smart about season two is that there's still racism permeated throughout. It's not as primary a focus as it was in season one. And I think a lot of that, like, I think we're sort of, like you were saying, accepting of it, because by season two, for the most part, Algy's kind of accepted at the hospital. People might not love him, but he's not questioned every time he goes into the operating room, right? Like, he's just there. Everybody knows he's a great doctor. But we get those moments where she's poking at the dinner table, or we get the blackface, the Wallace,
yes,
or whatever.
Yes, yes.
I was like, oh my God. Or then at the very end, in the final episode, I think, where Algy's talking to his dad, and his dad's like, you wouldn't, like, if I didn't keep my head down, like, we wouldn't be here. Like, and you think about, like, this is 1909 or whatever, and that guy, like, born before the Civil War. You know what I mean? Like, he's, like, in this world, and, like, you think about it, and it's not this primary focus, I don't think, of racism in season two. You know, in season one, it was very prevalent, but here, it's like, hey, this is always under the surface. You might not be remembering it, but, like, we're gonna bubble it up every once in a while.
Right.
And see, like, Algy, you know, watching the blackface, like the minstrels, and then, like, saying, you know, talking, like, you know, entertaining, like, one of us. Like it's just the way that, like, he's sort of become a part of this white society, but at the same time is not that at all. And, like, the way that they show him and his wife watching them, it's like this weird, really uncomfortable dichotomy of, like, how do we all feel? I mean, it's obviously wrong, but, like, how are they handling this situation?
Well, and they had said on the way into that show, to the entertainment that night, they were telling another couple, oh, we saw them already. Like, they had already been to that show and they loved it. So it is a very interesting, thorny look at how the insidiousness of, and as you say, sort of the social acceptance of, at this time, of this kind of racism.
Yeah, I was definitely less aware of it, again, going in this time, I feel, because I was just more settled into the way season one was playing, and this just plays differently from time to time. Like, I did get caught off guard at that dinner scene, and then again at Barrow's ball, the wife's ball, when the minstrels came out, I was like, this is crazy that Algy and his wife are into this performance. It kept having me look at myself, and that is uncomfortable, and to have the show do that, I think, is very strong. That's a very smart show.
We also have to talk about Birdie, because in addition to the Harriet and Cleary stuff, Birdie might be my favorite. I may have felt, yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to say because I love all these. I love so much of this show. We've talked in the past. I've talked a lot about in the past about Soderbergh shooting intimacy and his interest in intimacy. There's this great moment after so Birdie is sort of, as I read the show, had not had sex before he goes to this brothel and loses his virginity in this lovely little kind of scene. And then you get the first love scene with his girlfriend, with the journalist, and it's full of laughter, and he's done it before a little bit, but she hasn't, and it's extended, and it's able to be, I find it very sexy, but not because you're watching a lot of flesh flying around. Like, it's not a kind of easy sexy of, you know, you just turn on the camera and show a bunch of naked bodies. This is like, there's an earned intimacy that where we care about these characters, we care about them caring about each other, and they're kind of fumbling, but you get the sense that they have a real intimate connection. And I just think I thought that scene was handled so beautifully, and again, not a thing that you see on a lot of shows.
And we have to say that he shows up to the room in a towel and a top hat.
Yes.
And then she's like, why are you wearing that? He's like, I didn't want to be too forward. She's like, no, I want you to be forward. And then he drops the towel and puts the top hat over his junk.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then they do their thing. And then in master filmmaking, they smash cut from this loving moment, and smash cut the operative word, to a whorehouse where somebody is just like railing on a prostitute.
Right, right.
And it's like, this the same thing. Like, things are going on all over the city. And I feel like we got a lot more sex in season two. Not necessarily more nudity, but like everybody's sort of doing it in certain ways. And we're seeing how in the same, like, they're all professionally about the same point, but they're all so different behind closed doors. Like, Birdie is this inexperienced, like, almost virgin, and then, like, Nurse Elkins is, like, showing her new guy, like, how she's broken by Thackeray. Like, I can only have sex if I douse your junk in cocaine, and then, like, whatever, or, like,
liquid cocaine, yeah.
Hand jobs in the office during the day.
Yep. Which is, again, ultimate power move. Get it, Nurse Elkins. Like, just using it to get invited to that party, like, that's cool. I like that.
And then Thackeray not even doing it, and he's in the back alley with that girl, you know, like, in the garbage.
And I really do think it might sort of be like sex as a metaphor for where they are in life, right? Because like Thackeray's doing it in an alley. We have Barrow doing it with his former prostitute. We have Ever doing it with his wife's sister, this sort of weird, twisted, underhanded thing. We have Nurse Elkins into some real kinky shit. And like Birdie, we have this like this pure, gentle, good, loving. And it sort of feels like however they're having sex is like how they're doing in life.
Yeah, it's a great point. And because you have Thack also when he, what's the name of the woman who he cured of her syphilis and she has the, is that Abigail? Is that her name?
It is Abby, yes.
Abby, right.
And she's the one from season one that he fixed her nose, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because of her syphilis. There's a moment, as a stretch in this season, where one feels hopeful that he is going to balance his life out. It has to do with his intimacy with her. And I think you're onto something there. I hadn't thought about that, about the show sort of refracting all of their various, the trajectory of their characters through their sex lives. But the movie's doing that, or the show's doing that for a lot more characters than just, you know, than just Thackeray this season, which is good, I think.
Yeah, and I didn't think about it until just now either, but it just, as we're talking about it, it's like, oh, right, like, we can see what their mental state is by who they're having sex with and how they're having sex and where they're having sex. Lucy's using it for personal gain or just to, like, get her rocks off in the only way she can, and Thackeray's just getting it any way he can, just sort of like he's an addict to everything. And then Birdie's just, you know, gentle and pure.
And then you have Harry and Cleary who are making condoms.
Yes, yes.
Love it.
That whole thing, too. I love how she goes, you know, from being the abortionist to being the safe sex advocate. You know, along the same lines, just
two sides of the same coin, yeah.
Planned Parenthood is where she's, is what we're seeing the start of here, you know, and all that kind of stuff, too. But it all connects.
While you mention Cleary, I want to talk about, can we talk about Chekhov's baseball bat finally gets used? And they also yeah. comment on it. Like, we saw him last year and this year always with a baseball bat. He just wants to hit somebody so bad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then finally we get to that shady
Carney guy.
Frederick Weller. Yeah, yeah.
Circus owner, Carney guy, yeah, who demands that he gets his conjoined twins back who have already been separated, that there's these 12-year-old Swedish girls or whatever that's going to make a killing on. And it's this like unspoken ballet that Thackeray and Cleary play out. He's like sneaking up and he's like, oh yeah, he's just right over there. And then the way that he turns around and just gets popped in the face, I was like, oh yeah, like that's brutal, but that's like so cool. And he's like, hey, I finally got to use it. Like, we're like, yeah, like you finally got to actually use this menacing weapon you've been carrying around for like
yeah.
18 hours.
Yeah, and it's neat to see them, because the show is, this season is more diffuse, that not everybody is at the hospital or at the hospital all the time, that when the characters sort of circle back to one another again and you see how well they do work together, it reminds me of that episode in season one, it was the race riot one, right? Or where the African-Americans were all getting beat up and killed. And you see them all sort of, everybody in one spot sort of working together. Like those moments where you get to see how well they work together. The same thing happens often in the operating room. But that was a great one where the choreography of that told us a lot about who these people were, and you just got the sense of them sort of rubbing up into each other's lives for this moment and then headed another direction. And I found that very satisfying. Yeah.
And also the ambulance upgrade to an actual car. I thought was yeah. kind of funny too.
An electric car, yeah. There's a couple things. I'm just going through my notes right now. There's a couple things I want to point out that are really icky. I'm sure Tobin had a hard time when they're almost operating on Algie's eye.
Oh, God.
I was going back to Grey's Anatomy, where a relapsing or a detoxing or like a in need of cocaine Thackeray is like his hands quivering as, you know, Algie's eye is paralyzed. He's trying to do work on it. I'm like, oh, God. And then there's the episode a couple episodes later where he's just like poking the guy's brain. And I was like, oh, woo.
Oh, God. Oh.
That, oh, right. I loved that shit, though. That's the stuff that, like, I'm a huge sci-fi fan. And that, to me, felt like sort of going way back to Kafka, where he enters a room and there's people, like, poking at people's brains and stuff. And they're trying to, like, program it and everything. I was like, oh, this is the shit I love when, like, they open up the skull or whatever. I mean, this guy was missing this skull, which was even freakier. But yeah, that was some of the best shit for me because it was just like so surreal and weird and just fringe and shit. So I love that scene.
I have a quote here. This is a Birdie Thackeray exchange. And this is after, so Birdie leaves and he goes to Dr. Zinberg's hospital. He's not allowed to perform surgery. I mean, he does meet his girlfriend there, so that's a win for him. But he's not allowed to perform surgery. Everything is so slow. It's like this incremental progress that Dr. Zinberg does everything by the book, as opposed to Thackeray, where he's just like, hey, I'm going to operate on myself. Hey, we're going to cure syphilis with malaria, because why not? And he comes back and Birdie says, I need the speed of this place of you. And Thackeray says, maybe I've changed. Perhaps I'm not as reckless and fast as you remember. And Birdie says, Algernon told me last month you performed surgery with a telephone. And then Thackeray's like, well, some things have changed. Like, you know, there are other things that have changed since you left. But I was just like, we don't see that, but we don't doubt it. Like, I don't know how he used a telephone surgery, but like...
No, we saw
it. Oh, we did?
Yeah. He was listening for the shrapnel inside the guys who'd been brought in from the subway collapse.
Oh.
He tore the telephone apart. Remember the woman listened to the telephone and he would like, you know, when it would complete the circuit, it would ring in her ear. Remember that?
No, I don't remember that at all. I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Oh, we saw it. We saw it. Yeah. It was great.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that kind of flies by, you know. That's one of the things I love about it, though, is that they just throw away lines and stuff. Like, one thing that really amused me was when, I guess they were talking about, was it Cornelia's husband had to go, like, somewhere because the oil, something was going on with his oil company, and it turns out they discovered gasoline.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, it is just like, whatever, gasoline. And that was it. Like, we don't explore any of that at all whatsoever, but, yeah, it's just great how they just pepper things throughout.
Not only do they pepper things throughout, but I guess, like the telephone thing that I completely missed, apparently, there's the woman that Thackeray performs surgery on while he's in detox or rehab or whatever, where he straightens her nose with what he thinks is a gold earring, and she shows up to him, and she's like, don't you remember me? He's like, sorry, I don't. And she says, remember, I paid you in heroin. And like, Algy's in the room. He basically just like, well, I'm out of here. Like, I can't do this. But like, it's this little thing that, like, I don't even remember them like setting up. I think we just see in that facility, like, Thackeray's like just doing work on people's noses because they know who he is. And like, they don't really spend a lot of time on it.
Right.
But then one of these people comes back and it becomes this sort of slightly bigger thing. And it's this way of, you know, these scenes that would otherwise maybe be thrown off or thrown out or like just showing the passage of time for Thackeray come back in a way that work for the story, but is also funny on a couple different levels. Like Thackeray just not remembering at all. And then Algy being like, oh man, I can't, like, I'm not again with you. Like, I just can't.
And they're going to fix it with film.
Yeah. Celluloid. Yeah.
With celluloid. Yeah. With movie film. So like everything, it's cool how everything's tied together. Like, we get the first the first filmed procedure, surgery procedure thing. And I was like, oh my God, like, it's incredible how modern, I guess, but things really haven't changed. The only thing that's changed is the technology, but the idea has always been there, like 100 years ago, like doing the same thing, basically the same way, like record, like now you could just watch it on TV. That's just crazy to me. And that's just another thing that's just so nonchalant. It's just like, oh yeah, the movie camera exists now. But then, like, all these different applications, like, that's what I love also about Thackeray, the character, and why I just feel like he's so well written and the show is so smart, because he's able, as the character, to make all these connections that other people wouldn't. Like, now I'm advancing plastic surgery.
Yeah, there is so much technical advancement in the show that is just, as you say, alluded to and not, you know, dropped lines here or there that let you know how fast the world was moving at this point. I think I think about things move so much slower, you know, 100 years ago, and that we've become so used to rapid technological change just since the internet. But it's not true. Like, at this time, things were evolving so quickly. You know, one of the opening bits in season one, episodes 1, 2, 3, as they're like converting the hospital to electric power, to lights. And then by the end, every place you go has light. The ballrooms, the brothels, maybe not all the brothels, but some of them anyway.
The nice ones.
Electricity has come to New York in the space of however many years the show is taking place over, just a few. And I think that's sort of, I found that sort of jarring, but also jarring because it felt so modern, felt so contemporary.
On the other side of that coin, I mean, it's more in season one than it is here, but we have what seems to be Dr. Zinberg, like, making all these like radical inventions, but then we see how he works, and like, he's not doing that. Like, he just is very methodical about it. And like, I guess there's sort of two schools of thought, that like, there's the way that he does it, and he's slowly but surely getting to the race, and that sort of trickles over to Birdie, who finds adrenaline or potassium chloride or whatever to revitalize dead rabbits. But then we have Thackeray like, hey, like, what if we jack up people's temperatures by 8 degrees and, like, that'll maybe, you know, get rid of syphilis? Like, there's two very different ways that we see the progress going, but, like, everybody's contributing in one way or the other, and it's cool to see the way that this all happens.
Right, and that syphilis cure is a real thing, too. That's another thing that they actually would do to cure syphilis, would be to give people malaria.
Yeah, and I also feel like that just connects to an overall theme of the season where it's, or maybe even just the series in general, where it's like, if you're going to play by the rules, it's going to take forever, you know, and like you're only going to make incremental advancements, you know, you're going to be stuck in this hospital that first we test on mice, then we test on the next pig, then guinea pigs, then pigs, and maybe next year a person, maybe. But then you could go to the NIC and, you know, there are no rules. And it's like, we're splitting Siamese twins, we're curing syphilis, we're doing nose jobs, like, we're, you know, we're doing the whole thing with the hernia over here, we have algae here, like, we're bending rules, we're breaking rules, we're writing our own rules. And I think that is, you know, part of the show, where it's like, you could either do what society tells you and take the long way, or you could go your own way and take the shortcut and hopefully survive. But that is the way to achieve, and that's the way you're going to make these quantum leaps in medicine and advancements. And not just that, but also, like, people are going to work their way into society that wouldn't normally be there and change ideas in people's minds, and people are going to start thinking differently because different types of thinking people are now part of that social status.
And then you see characters in the people who are recruiting Gallinger with the eugenics business, who are using the arguments of medical and technological and scientific advancement to hold back progress, right? Like, to push back against a more inclusive, diverse, multi-voiced society, the backlash to all of this progress, which is, again, a historical thing that you see over and over again of progress and backlash, progress and backlash. And I think that's, the show plays that. I don't think the show overplays that. I think it plays that kind of just right. And it finds its perfect, you know, supervillain in in Gallinger, who starts out this season doing the best thing for Thack, getting him out of the sanitarium and on this boat and drying him out. You know, he does this sort of heroic thing and then ends up being sort of the turn to the villain in the end. I appreciated what they did with his character here.
And I think that chronologically it comes much earlier, but I think that same idea is seen when we get that flashback of Thackeray down in Nicaragua.
Oh, Nicaragua. Yeah, I totally forgot why he owed him one.
Well, I mean, that's also kind of, I guess, not a shout out to Che, but like it sort of looked kind of like Che more than the rest of this.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But in terms of the progress and the holding back of progress, like, the people that call him down there lie about the disease. He's like, I could have cured this if you had just been honest with me. And they're like, well, if we told you the truth, like, we wouldn't be able to sell crops. And, like, in all these different ways, like, people have these different sort of selfish goals or, like, ways that they think they're helping or whatever. And the show is always about, like, look how much better things could have been if people were just, like, honest and upfront and, like, you know, open about everything. But it's all that kind of thing. Like, it's the whole Thackeray's just trying to do right by the world. He's, like, he's breaking every rule, but, like, he genuinely wants to help the world. Like, he wants to get to a point where nobody dies from taking either before they get surgery. He doesn't want anybody to go through the pain that he did when Abby died. He's doing things maybe the wrong way, but he's still doing things in a way that is for the greater good. And then you have Gallinger doing what he's doing, and you have this guy down in Nicaragua, you know, the subterfuge of that. And it's just like, I don't want everybody like Thackeray, but if you have like a mixture of like Thackerays and Birdies all around the world, like, things would be a lot better.
It's tough because, like, it depends partially on, like, position. You know, Thackeray, yeah, like, if he screws up, a patient will die. But what about the guy who's letting sick passengers go, you know, without getting turned back, and he's causing a plague? You know what I'm saying? So, like, is the risk worth the consequence at times? And, like, it depends kind of on what level you're playing the game at, you know? And, like, it gets more and more dire. Like, I feel like Thackeray, like, I'm glad he's breaking rules. Like, I'm glad he's kind of doing what he's doing, you know, even though, like, he's losing patients here and there. But then again, you know, with Cornelia's brother, he's playing the same game, but, like, what he's doing is causing the freaking plague. Different levels, but the same thing.
And for different reasons, right? Like Cornelia's brother is doing it for money and power. He says as much. And Thak's doing it, yeah, sure, for glory, but also to save lives and for the advancement of understanding and science. I think the show, is, again, this is Soderbergh's critique of the economic system we have set up for ourselves, where those who are doing this at a high level for money and power achieve, and those who are doing it for more selfless reasons burn brightly and do great work and then die. So I don't think that's probably an accident.
But what a spectacular death.
Oh, it's what a scene. I was so emotional in that scene, even as I knew kind of what was happening, you know, like, and you know it's coming when you realize what he's going to try and do. But I found myself tearing up as his end is coming, and I didn't want him to go.
Well, his final words are just so perfect. He just has this epiphany at the end, and yeah. It's like, this is all we are. And he's literally, what he is sprawled out in front of him. Like, it's great.
Yeah. And those lines were lines that he wanted to say somewhere in the final scene. And the writers were like, oh, that sounds like the last words he would say. And so they wrote that in as his last words. That was Clive Owen's idea.
And it almost feels like it should be the last words of the show, but it's not. I mean, there's not that many words after that, but we get the button. Like, I think the last thing that we hear is Algy talking to the patient, right? I think that's the last thing.
He says, tell me about it. Tell me, like, he's the guy who said, I'm having bad dreams. And he said, tell me about them, after a long pause, and then it cuts to black. It's just so fucking good, you guys. It's so fucking good.
That's something that's, like, every time the screen fades to black and says directed by Steven Soderbergh, like, I'm happy and angry, because it's always at exactly the right point.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, I want more, but I also get why it's here. I also feel like, and this is something that I noticed just because, as usual, I waited a little bit too long to start this, and so I sort of crammed through. And I think that's also maybe why I liked the back half more, because I did it, like, in sort of two big chunks, as opposed to just one or two a day or whatever. But, like, I was looking at the episodes of the season, and I was like, how much time do I actually need? And I feel like, on average, these were all almost a solid hour. The first season were sort of more like in the 48 to 52, sometimes up to 55, but here it's like, there's just more of it, which is, when it's going great, like, exactly what I want.
Yeah, it feels more consistently at 52 or 57. Again, I'm clearly in the tank for the show, but they didn't feel lagging to me. Like, it felt like he was, as you say, you get to the end, you're like, yeah, this feels like the end, but I want more. And until that last episode, there was more to watch, and then it was all gone.
I think part of that for me is that's a positive aspect. Like, I just feel like more was going on this entire season. I mean, first season, we really have to establish characters and, you know, have a central focus mostly on Thackeray and stuff. But, like, this season, we were really able to sort of, like, open up the world. I really feel like that carnival place they go to is, like, some kind of nexus of the Nick universe. All characters have been there, but not all at the same time, but it connects them all together. Just that it tried to be a little more sprawling and open up and get into the minutiae more of other characters. I think stuff like that kept it going, paced it a little quicker for me, actually. And so that is as a positive aspect of what I just considered maybe there being too much covered here, but maybe not.
Now, I want to ask a question. We know that Tobin is in the bag for the show, but Tobin, if you had to rank this, I mean, this is not on Letterboxd. We can't rank it on Letterboxd. As of right now, Out of Sight is your number one, right?
Yep.
What's your top three? Is it Out of Sight and then The Limey?
Out of Sight, Ocean's 11, and The Limey are my top three. I'm looking at it right now.
Where would this fall?
I had this open because I was going to ask you guys the same question. And as I sit here right now, one minute I'm like, it's number two. And the next minute, it's number one. I love this show. This does all the stuff that I love Soderbergh doing all in one show. And I feel like there's a consistency of voice because he's, like, literally behind the camera for the whole thing. Maybe at number three. Maybe I would say number three. Out of Sight, Ocean's 11, and The Nick. But it could very easily, day to day, slide up and down that scale. But I can't imagine it getting much lower than number three. What about you guys?
Well, I think it's fair to put it behind two things that we've called perfect movies.
I think Out of Sight is a perfect movie. Yeah, but this may be a perfect show for me.
It's definitely not for me. I really like it. Like, that was when we finished season one. I was like, you know, this might be, like, I have a list. I don't know how confident I am in my list because TV shows are so much harder, I think, to rank than movies, because it's like, how do you compare 20 hours of this to, like, 110 for Lost or something? You know what I mean? Like, it's a very different scale. But, like, when we finished season one, I was like, oh, this might be in my top 25. Like, I might, you know, I love this. I love where this went. And then, like, front half, as I've been saying, the front half of season two, I was like, oh, like, that's sort of disappointing. And then, like, by the end, I was like, oh, so this might be sort of on the cusp. I don't think it's a perfect show for me. Maybe knowing where everything goes, watching it again, because I do think it's very rewatchable. I would like it more. I would put this... So I have Out of Sight, Ocean's 11, then Haywire. I might put this 4 or 5,
mm-hmm.
right after Haywire and right around Aaron Brockovich. Above The Informant, for sure. But above everything else that he's done.
Middle of your top 10, basically.
Middle of my top 10. I think some of the best hours are as good as anything he's ever made. I think that there's other things, like threads and storylines and scenes and episodes, where I'm just like, eh. Like, it's, like, I don't think any of this is bad. I think it's just not what I was hoping for, or not what I was expecting, or not what I was sort of trained to watch. I don't know, but definitely top 5 somewhere.
Mike, what about you?
Yeah, this is a tough one. I haven't really been watching a lot of TV shows recently to sort of put it up against. I mean, I love it.
TV is really good, Mike. You gotta get on it. TV's pretty good.
I mean, I guess I love TV. I like movies more, but I really like this as a show. I mean, it's an amazing show. Like, I don't know if that can actually be stressed enough, because there's just so many great shows out there, but this is definitely top tier. I mean, and I think it being on premium cable has something to do with that too, right? Like, it's not an AMC show, it's not on USA, it's not, you know, it's not on any of that kind of stuff. Like, you have to pay for it, and I would pay for it. I'd pay for more of it, you know. I don't know exactly where I'd put it, because, like, looking at what I have, like, I might have to rearrange some things on my list, but I you know, 5 or 6, like, it's tough, because I love The Limey, I love Out of Sight, Ocean's 11, and Schizopolis. Like, for me, those 4 movies, like, for the most, I might have to switch Haywire with Magic Mike, but I don't know. I'd probably put it somewhere in 4, 5, or 6, floated around in that area. It's before Informant, it's before Aaron Brockovich, it's before Contagion and Sex Lies, and that's the rest of my top 10. So, yeah, in middle of my top 10. It's one of those shows, like, I think about it a lot, like, the, you know, as I'm away from it, like, things pop into my head, and that's a mark of a great show to me. Like, you know, I stopped watching Walking Dead after season 1 because I was getting nothing from it.
Can I say, so as we're recording this, the spring season, or whatever, because they split everything in halves, comes back this Sunday. So we're recording this at the beginning of February. I saw my TiVo was going to record the new episode of Walking Dead on Sunday, and I was like, ugh. Like, I'm so committed to it by now. Like, I haven't missed an episode. I'm like, that shouldn't be my reaction to, like, a show coming back. But, like, that's where we are. But I've also seen, like, 105 hours of it. Like, I can't not watch, I don't know. But I get where you're going. But sorry, go ahead.
This is a great show, worth your time. Definitely check it out. You know, this guy Soderbergh, like, I don't know where the hell he finds the time. I'm convinced he has a time machine, or there's 2 of him.
Yeah, he's got a twin, yeah.
Like, he's doing the Prestige thing, like, you know? Imagine how amazing that would be, that he's been a twin this whole time, or a triplet even, but...
Wait, a question for that. Like, before we get off that idea, would that be amazing, or would it be like, oh, that's how he does it? And, like, it's sort of like, now you understand how the trick is done. You're like, oh, it's sort of less impressive. Like, would that be more impressive, or would it be less impressive?
I would be very impressed.
Okay.
I'm sure the shock would wear off pretty quickly and be like, all right, now get back to work.
Both of you get back to work.
Yeah.
Stevens.
The Stevens Soderbergh, yeah.
So I'm very much looking forward to checking out Mosaic now, because high quality television from this guy now. A far cry from where he started trying to do television way back on that Noir Showtime special thing, and a few other little missteps, maybe K-Street.
And K-Street. Yep.
Hey now.
Just as a quick aside, we will be covering Mosaic. It'll come out in 2 weeks. Next week, we have Logan Lucky, which is, spoiler alert, another one of his movies in my top 10. And then we have Mosaic the week after that, so...
Is it really?
I love Logan Lucky. Have you seen it yet or no?
Yeah, but I wouldn't...
You don't like it that much?
Not that much. Okay. No, yeah.
I didn't rank it yet, because I haven't rewatched it for the show.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, Tobin, yeah. I have a Channing Tatum podcast, and I love Riley Keough.
Of course.
And I got 2 words for you, Joe Bang.
I sort of want to keep soaking in this show. Like, to me, it doesn't feel like a show. That's why it's hard for me to rank this with other TV shows. Like, I write down my list of, like, okay, there's The Wire, there's Friday Night Lights, there's The Sopranos. Like, there are these great best of TV shows.
I watched all of those last year.
Like Deadwood. And this...
I watched that last year, too.
This almost doesn't feel fair to put this... This feels like a really long movie to me. Like, this feels like one long story, which is why it feels like more like sort of putting it up against other movies makes more sense somehow for me. But, like, people out there, get yourself to wherever this is and watch this show. This is a fucking amazing show. I'm pounding the table, and then I'll shut up, that you have to watch The Nick. And I think you have to watch it more than once, and I think it's a work of genius.
Well, I think you can probably do a sample trial to Cinemax on Amazon, I'm guessing, and probably see it all on there. So go do that. It does sort of feel like a longer movie, and I don't know how you compare this to a show like The Sopranos that has 86 hours, The Wire that has 60 hours, or Friday Night Lights that has 60 hours.
It's more like something like Twin Peaks: The Return, you know what I mean? Where it's
Yes.
like a
Yeah.
very crafted.
But that's still the same thing. Like, I don't know how you compare that to a movie because you know so much more about Thackeray than you do about like Erin Brockovich or something.
Well, I think just in the sense that it's auteur driven, that David Lynch directed every episode of The Return and that Soderbergh directed every episode of The Nick, you know, so it's just that it's very much their work and the way that a movie is, you know, and that they're in control of telling the entire story through their eyes, that the way that they would tell a feature film. I feel it's just much longer.
Before we wrap up, I want to go through a couple quick hit movie things of note. Number one, as we're recording, it just was announced that Steven Soderbergh is going to be directing a NBA drama starring Andre Holland, aka Algernon, from this show. So that'll be out sometime.
Just to say, written by the co-writer of Moonlight.
Yeah, which also Andre Holland was in and
Right.
great in that too. So
And he was in Selma and yeah, okay, anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
I wrote on Facebook and Twitter when I shared that story that like people make fun of Cage or you know talk about how Cage makes so many movies, but like there's more Soderbergh stuff that's come out since like we've seen Cage, like Unsane. Unsane is basically the Cloverfield paradox. Like, hey, I made this movie and it's coming out in March. Like, it's just, hey, this is a thing that I did, and oh, by the way, I might only shoot on iPhones now. Like, okay, that's number one. Number two, I just did an episode. This is, again, comes out a couple months ago. We did the episode of Moneyball for P.S. I Love Hoffman. He was supposed to direct that. You know, I don't know if either of you heard that episode, but he had this idea for that. He was going to cast the actual baseball players in the parts. And I was like, even when it's not a movie he's making, he can't help but be himself. And I love that movie, but I also would have loved a Soderbergh version of it with actual David Justice and actual. Maybe he gets Billy Beane. I don't know. Who knows? No, I guess Brad Pitt was always going to be there, but like, gets David Justice and gets Scott Hattieburg and all these different people. Like, that would have been great. And the only other thing that I want to say was that for Magic Mike's, the episode that came out in February, which as we're recording this is next week, as you're listening to this was about 2 months ago, was the movie Havoc, starring Anne Hathaway from 2005. And it's a very bad movie. Don't see it. However, what blew my mind, and this is a teaser for both of you. I don't think Tobin listens to Magic Mike's. I know that Mike does. Laura San Giacomo plays Anne Hathaway's mom. Laura San Giacomo from Sex, Lies, and Videotape in that movie masturbates on camera for James Spader. In Havoc, there is a terrible plot device where this guy is making a documentary of their crew, and at one point is alone with Anne Hathaway and films her, and she masturbates on camera. And I was like, in my head, I was like, this is the same character from Sex Lies that this woman grew up, had Anne Hathaway as a daughter, and like mother, like daughter, can't control themselves when they're around video cameras. Like, I've never seen another movie that's not some Skinamax thing or whatever, you know what I mean? In actual sort of Hollywood movies with people you know, I was like, what are the odds that Laura San Giacomo is going to be in two movies where women masturbate in front of video cameras? Like, that's crazy.
It's a cinematic universe there of some kind.
The Skin-O-Matic universe. That's all I got. Tobin, any other thoughts about The Nick season two or The Nick as a show other than you just gushing about it for another hour and a half?
Oh yeah, I got thoughts and thoughts and thoughts. I could go on for days here, but I won't. I just again implore everyone to seek out the show. I will definitely watch this again, and I will watch the commentaries, and I will soak this thing up. I have so much to learn from how they did this show. I just feel like I feel like I'm a surgeon, and I need to open it up and sort of dig around inside and see how it was put together. I'm not ready to say this is a perfect show, but I'm not ruling that out either. I think The Nick is awesome.
And Mike?
I love this show. I love all the actors on this show. You know, I understand it can't go on forever, and two seasons, it's still a lot. And even though I feel like it can go on, I like knowing that this was their plan. Like, once I know that this is their plan, I'm fine. It's not like with Deadwood where it got canceled and they were never able to do anything, and there's like this legendary movie that may or may not be happening. I think that's great, you know, the closure, the completeness. Like, not that there's closure necessarily, but just as a viewer, I feel like it's over. Like, it's complete. Like, it's a good place to sort of get out of this story. And I understand more now, you know, why they would sort of pick it up, you know, 40 years later with completely different characters. Who knows? Maybe Birdie's son could be one of the characters, like something along those lines or something. The Nick kids. Maybe not. But yeah, you know, this is a great show. I'm so glad that this show exists. And I'm glad that now I can track these actors again as they go on and do other work. You know, Clive Owens can get back to making movies, and that'll be great. And I look forward to Mosaic. And I, you know, hope Soderbergh just keeps going. All of the Steven Soderberghs that he is, just all keep working. You know, you did this while you were retired. Like, what the fuck? Like, that is just insane.
Yeah, this was his retirement. Yeah.
I'm just gonna make this amazing show, no big deal. And now he's out of retirement. It was a really good time to be a Soderbergh fan.
I think that is important to note. We didn't say that, but this was like the end. He's like, I'm done. And then I guess probably within a year was like, all right, time to make Logan Lucky. And then like put it out 8 months after that or whatever. But this was the end of his quote unquote career. I guess the quote unquote end of his career, whatever, however you want to say it. Since then, came back with Logan Lucky and Mosaic and Unseen and this basketball drama and who knows what else. But it is super exciting. Again, this is probably going to be the director with the most films that we ever cover on here. Because I also don't think that of people who have been making movies starting around 1990, like, I don't think there's been more prolific directors. So this is like a weird place to start, but it's also, I think, a great place to start, setting the bar really high here for Cinemakers. But I'm glad that we started here. It's not over yet by any means. We still have another two or three episodes before this initial run concludes. But yeah, I mean, I'm thrilled to have done Soderbergh. I'm excited to have seen the show. Like, this was always a show that I wanted to watch, but I'm glad that I had a reason to watch it, that I had to like set aside time to watch it for this. I'm glad that I had people to talk about it with. And again, like Tobin's been saying all episode, go find it, go watch it. Whether you like dramas, it's good. Whether you like gross stuff, it's good. Whether you like, you know, hyper violence and like sex and like the other things that are typically associated with like prestige pay channel dramas and shows, like it's all there. Like, whatever you want to watch a show for, if you want to watch like a funny show, like it's not consistently funny, like it's not trying to be funny,
it is top hat over your junk.
It is top hat on your dick funny.
So, you know,
but yeah, I mean, like, whatever you want to find in this show, you can find. Go check it out. It was nominated for Outstanding Directing for a Drama Series. They submitted the finale, This Is All We Are. It was nominated for Outstanding Hairstyling, Makeup, and Production Design, but it did not win any of those. And then the year before, it had won Production Design. It was nominated for a bunch of other stuff, so didn't really win too much, but.
I'm surprised because it's, you know, the period part of it as a period piece is like immaculate. Whatever effects they had to do digitally to create the streets or whatever, the set extensions is just not since the John Adams miniseries have I just been like floored about handheld CGI matte paintings and all that kind of stuff. It's just beautiful, beautiful.
So both directing in the drama series and also drama series both went to Game of Thrones.
Oh, man.
The directing went to Battle of the Bastards, which is the Jon Snow against Ramsay Snow, Ramsay Bolton, that epic battle. So, I mean, that was visually spectacular. I know it's a different kind of show, and I'm not saying Game of Thrones is as good as this, but I can see why the Emmys would, you know, look at this battle with like thousands of extras and admire it over sort of a contained show. I mean, beautiful in every way, but
Yeah.
what I'm saying, TLDR, TV is great. Mike, watch more TV.
Yes, exactly. And everybody else, go watch the Nick.
For all things Cinemakers, and also all things that I've done with Joe too, go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or @cageclubpod on Twitter. Like we said at the very top, this is our 30th episode of the show, so there's lots of Soderbergh talk that you can catch up on. Last week, we put out the season 1 episode of The Nick, so go back and check that out if you didn't. It would be weird, I think, for you to listen to this one and not listen to the first one. Maybe. I don't know. But cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, @cageclubpod on Twitter. Podcast is available to be subscribed to anywhere you find podcasts. Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play. Rate, review, subscribe, say nice things. Email us, cinemakers@cageclub.me. We will for sure get this up email after we're done recording this, but we'll figure out a way to, I guess, address it. I don't know. Who knows? Anyway, go to those places. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Tobin Adams.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.